So I said this to a few people already, but I would like you to know that 5 years ago when we had Tricep here, one of my friends beat Cliff in a dancing contest. So.
I remember that.
Yes. There's no like video evidence, but there is a tweet, so I can prove that it happened.
Is that why we don't have a dancing competition this time?
That's up to y'all. I didn't plan this. Okay, well, hey, everyone. Thanks for sticking around for the last talk. I know everybody is a little bit tired because after 2 weeks of Tricep, sort of everybody's brain starts to leak out of their ears. So today I have like a slightly more qualitative slash pheno talk for you that's going to start off on the blackboard, and then I'll sort of show you some figures. So the topic is ALPs, axion like particles, and why we love them. This was the title that Cliff chose, but I wholeheartedly agree. But in any case, there's sort of really two main parts of the talk. We're going to start by introducing axions and axion-like particles. What even is the difference, and why do we like them? So I'm going to sort of motivate them from the QCD side, and then also from the string theory BSM side. I'm going to warn you right now that I know very little about string theory other than I can call in it as a reasonable way to get axions. So it'll be a little bit hand-wavy. And then once we have our sort of nomenclature a little bit in order, because it is rough, we're going to talk about the parameter space and pheno of axions, because it is quite vast. And depending on sort of what mass and what sort of mechanism you're looking at, they can behave kind of differently. And you look for them in different ways. So we're sort of just going to breeze by the QCD axion and direct detection, because Nick already told you about that in the fourth dark sector lecture. We're going to briefly talk about how axions can even be dark energy. I'm going to introduce black hole superradiance, which is a topic that I first learned about at this summer school 5 years ago, so I think it's cool to come full circle. I don't have a lot of expertise on it. I just think it's awesome. And then we're going to talk about fuzzy or ultralight dark matter, which is sort of what my expertise is in and is the expertise of at least four other people in this room. So you can ask each other questions as well. And so that's sort of what we're going to wrap up with. Okay. So on the QCD side, you have already sort of seen the strong CP problem, which comes from the fact that our Lagrangian has a term that looks a little bit something like this. Right, where this is the gluon field. And this is like the dual of the gluon field. And so this is an issue, of course, because we would expect an electric dipole moment to be induced and look something like the combination of these terms. Where MQ here is the quark mass matrix, and theta is this theta. And we, of course, through many experiments, expect this to be like smaller than 10 to the minus 26, which is pretty small where I come from. And so this posits sort of a fine-tuning problem of why would the universe choose something like this? And so one way to solve this is by introducing the Pache-Quinn mechanism that Nick told you about, and you get a sort of pseudoscalar particle out of it called the axion, which was once called the Higlet, by the way, which I think is kind of a cute name. But axion won out. No, come back. Good. Axion won out. The story is that it was the name of a soap, and it cleans up the problem quite nicely. And it just so happens that this axion, this sort of like pseudoscalar particle, is also a good dark matter candidate, right? And so you get sort of two problems solved for the price of one, which is quite nice. So from Nick's lecture, you saw that the mass of the axion times Fa should be something like the mass of the pion times F pi. And so basically that if we assume that Fa, the scale breaking, is something below the Planck scale, we have the mass of the axion is greater than 10 to the minus 12 eV in the QCD axion. So this is higher than the ultralight dark matter that I'm going to talk about. I still have to motivate that. Of course, if you work on WIMPs, this might already seem ultralight to you, but it gets lighter. Um, We also want some relationship between the mass of the axion and like 1 over FA, aka the coupling strength. And so you can sort of posit different models that tell you how the coupling to, say, the weak sector, so GA gamma gamma, depends on MA. And sort of two of these models that I'm just going to mention, because they get mentioned a lot, are the so-called DFSZ. It's the Dine, Fisher, Sredniki, Jutinski, and then the KSVZ, the Kim, Schiffman, Weinstein, Zakharov, I believe. And so these are sort of QCD axion models that are popular, often the band that we aim for with direct detection experiments, which you'll see in a little bit. So hopefully this is mostly just a review of what Nick has told you, and it's not super, super new. So on the other hand, we can call up on, like, say, string theory or some other form of BSM, if you like, that will sort of predict pseudoscalar fields into low energy EFT. So in string theory, you would call these string axions. Or if you call upon string theory to motivate them, you might call them string axions. And we can have hundreds of such fields, not necessarily just one. So of these hundreds of fields, these fields can remain massless or get some super high mass that we don't necessarily care about in EFT land. They can pick up mass from QCD-like effects. And so you can get the QCD axion from such a motivation, but it's not a priori evident that you do. It requires some model building to say that I want the QCD axion to pop out of this, and so I am going to build my model such that it does. So only one linear combination of these fields will get its mass from QCD. And so you'll get a QCD axion from this over FA, which is some linear combination of some fields I. And the C here has to do with how you build your string theory model. On the other hand, other combinations can pick up a light mass in a different way, say coupling to photons. And so these are ALPs. These are axion-like particles. So to note here is that like I said, so we don't necessarily generically produce the QCD axion. You have to really want to do so and sort of build your model around that. But you can have a lot of these fields. Some of these lighter fields are fields that I'm interested in and that we'll be talking about a lot. And so you could have multiple of these fields with mass that could all contribute to, say, the dark matter, in which case you have an axiverse. Which would mean that you have multiple masses of axions sort of floating about and making out, say, the dark matter budget of the universe. Yeah.
I was wondering why the axion is a pseudoscalar. Is it possible to have a scalar axion?
Is it a priori massless?
Or is it related to the
I think it is related.
To the parity of that term.
I think it is related in some way. I believe that it's mostly a pseudoscalar if you wanted to have a mass and have be a dark matter candidate, but I couldn't tell you the mechanism that does that. So, sorry. Okay, but so these are sort of the two ways that you can motivate the QCD axion axion-like particles and, say, the axiverse in the case that you have multiple axion fields. For the most of this talk, I'll just consider that we have one axion field, and I'll primarily be interested in it as something that makes up the bulk of dark matter, the dark matter budget of the universe. But we can sort of relax that assumption at the end and think about what that would do to some of the bounds that we have. So with that, this is what I came in early to draw. I'm going to start sketching some mass exclusion plots for you, and then in the end, I will motivate those by showing you the actual plots from paper so you know that I didn't completely make it up. So on a mass range, on a mass scale that goes from like 1 EV to 10 to the minus 33 EV, or like rather 10 EV to 10 to the minus 33 EV, over here in the heavier end, we are mostly dealing with the QCD axion that might live somewhere on this line if you're considering the KVSC or the DFSV axion models, for instance. So these are pretty common. And these are the things that Nick talked to you about with direct detection experiments. So sort of this top is ruled out by CAST, which I know that he mentioned in some other experiments. And then a bunch of, say, haloscopes are sort of trying to get down to this line around here and probe this parameter space. And so when you're here and when you're looking for the QCD axion, the coupling strength matters. That is something that you're careful about when constructing your experiment and when analyzing your data. For most of the lighter particles, so from minus 10 on here, we're not necessarily using the coupling to the standard model to look for our axions. And so there's no vertical axis here. So here we're just sort of ruling in or out or discussing how one might rule in or out axions in a different mass range. And if you're impatient and want to look at this plot, I got it from this paper. I don't guarantee that this is the newest possible exclusion plot. This is just one that seems sort of simple and mentions some of the stuff that you discussed in the dark sector. So that is the QCD axion and sort of direct detection experiments. One other thing that I want you to recall from the dark sector lecture is that you talked about how when H, where H is the Hubble Hubble parameter, is much greater than MA, the axion field sort of acts like a constant because it hasn't begun oscillating yet. However, when H is much smaller than MA, then you get some oscillation. And it starts scaling like matter in the universe, and then it becomes sort of a good and compelling dark matter candidate. So in natural units, H0 today, which I'm just going to say is 100 H kilometers per second per megaparsec, which is one of the weirdest units invented in physics, turns out to be like 10 to the minus 33 HeV. And if you're not a cosmologist and you're not used to this convention, this is just where we hide our insecurity about what the Hubble constant actually is. So this is approximately 0.7. It might be 0.6, it might be 0.8, but it's sort of on that order. So that means that for an axion of mass on the order of 10 to the minus 33 EV, it hasn't begun oscillating yet. It's just about to start oscillating. So we have a constant in the universe. So below about here, any axion field with that mass is actually, you can't see that, would actually scale like dark energy. So below here, we're not really interested in the axion as a dark matter candidate for that reason. Okay, so we've sort of bounded the axion from the top here, right? With the QCD axion, we've sort of bounded it from the bottom with dark energy, which leaves us only about two decades of mass to deal with. And this is the part that I find really fun because it's kind of quantum. It's not actually quantum. It's a classical system. But we can use some ideas from quantum. By which I mean, you can treat a lot of things in here vaguely like the hydrogen atom. Yes?
So about the axion as dark energy, mm-hmm. Is that because when you the equation of the state order will be just minus one if there are not oscillating around a minimum with P over rho over
yeah, P, yeah, yes. Yeah, so it was because you would basically have a cosmological constant addition that comes from the fact that the axion hasn't started oscillating yet. Because that Hubble friction term that sort of Nick showed for you is too strong still. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions?
Here.
Yeah.
How piezoelectric effect is related to that Lagrangian?
I have no idea. Sorry. It's been a good long while since I've thought about the piezoelectric effect. Other questions? Okay, we're gonna end up super early. Okay. So now that we sort of bounded it on both sides, let's consider this area between about minus 10 and minus 20. And this is where I want to introduce the idea, you know what, I'm actually just gonna start on another board because it's gonna get too low. So from 10 to the minus 20, 10 to the minus 10-ish. So vaguely in this range, we can use something called black hole superradiance. So this is nice because this doesn't necessarily depend on the coupling of axions in the standard model, which means that you can sort of test a wide variety of scenarios so long as some conditions are satisfied. And the conditions are as follows. So somewhere in the universe, we have a rotating Kerr black hole that looks a little something like this, right? And it is rotating with an angular speed of omega bh. If we also assume that there exists a bosonic field in the universe, with a de Broglie wavelength dB on the order of the size of the black hole, we will get this effect, which is that the boson field will form sort of an orbital around the black hole. And so long as the this boson field is in some state and has some angular velocity omega b divided by m, where m is not the mass, it's the magnetic moment, like of nLm, the angular momentum in the direction of omega bh.
Excuse me?
Yes?
Those characters in the last line of this three...
Sorry, these? Yeah, OK. I have terrible handwriting. Please stop me at any moment, and I will rewrite anything for you. So.
Separate from the same.
So this is lambda de Broglie, so lambda dB. Is approximately RBH. So the wavelength of the bosonic field is approximately on the order of the size of the black hole. Other questions about my handwriting or otherwise?
The axion has, that's the property of the axion with respect to the.
Yes, yes. So this is set by the inverse mass of the axion.
We're saying that that's the case, or we're saying we're studying what happens in that case?
We're studying what happens in that case.
Ah, okay.
Right, so basically what I'm trying to motivate here is like, look at the size of this parameter space that we could have of axions, right? Because there's nothing constraining us from having any of these masses, not really. And so to look for an axion in different areas of this parameter space, I think requires like very different interesting physical effects, and that's what I'm sort of trying to illustrate here. So over here, you might be looking for something with like direct detection experiments. Over here, you might be looking like something by super radiance. That doesn't mean you're going to find it, but it's a really, really cool idea. Yeah?
Is the curve black hole charged?
I think it's important that it's spinning. I don't think it necessarily. So we're thinking about like an astrophysical black hole.
OK, so You said m is just the angular momentum around.
No, sorry. So. I see. Okay. So this refers to the field. So this refers to the bosonic field and not to the not to the black hole itself. So I'm saying that the boson field is forming some orbital and has some total angular momentum omega b, and then divided by the angular momentum in the direction of the black hole spin. Good?
Is that like a p wave?
Yeah, I think so. All right. So, right, that is kind of what I was getting at. So what we have here has been sometimes called the gravitational atom, right, where the black hole is the nucleus, and the ALPS, or the boson field here, are, you know, the electron cloud in some orbital, which I think is a pretty cool thing to get on a large scale. So if this indeed exists and you're looking to sort of rule it out or rule it in, there are two things that you might be looking for. So the observables might be, one, you might be looking for gravitational waves from transitions between orbitals. Or, and this is the bit that I'm going to talk about, you can look for spin down of the black hole, which will happen while the following condition is satisfied. So the classical way to think about this might be if you have something like a rotating cylinder and you throw a ball at it, if the ball is traveling slower than the cylinder is rotating, it might bounce off the cylinder with sort of some additional speed. So what's happening is that that energy is being transferred from the black hole, and the black hole is spinning down. And so what you do to look for this is you look at things like population statistics of black holes. And so people have indeed done this. Sorry, I didn't break anything.
There's a thing hanging down on that.
Sorry? Oh, well, too late. I promise I'll use it next time so I don't injure myself or others. Okay, so what is happening here is that if you're looking at the population of black holes in the universe, and if these boson fields just exist anywhere in the universe, then this has to happen. And so you expect the populations of black holes to not be spinning that fast. And so people have put limits on boson masses between 10 to the minus 11, 10 to the minus 14. So these are stellar mass. And also from 10 to the minus 16 to about 10 to the minus 20, which are supermassive black holes. The most interesting one, I think, is that there's a paper that even puts a limit on the existence of such bosonic fields, looking at a single image of a black hole, so around 10 to the minus 21, and that's the EHT limit of M87 star, which is to basically say it's been around too long and it's spinning too fast to have a bosonic field around it, draining it of its angular momentum.
Those are regions of study or excluded?
So those are regions that are claimed to be excluded by the following papers. And because the thing here is you're just saying that if a field like this exists, this would happen. You're not necessarily saying anything about the field being dark matter. or the field coupling to the standard model. You are just saying that if it existed, these populations of black holes would be spinning slower. And so it's a very different way to put a bound. Yeah?
Are we talking about the Penrose mechanism, or is it different? For the spin down.
For the actual spin down, I think yes. I think yes, but I'd have to double check in the original paper. So by the way, this is the talk that I heard when I was here 5 years ago. I heard it from Masha Baryakhtar, but it's also done by Mina, who's here. So there have been a lot of papers about sort of black hole spin down and black hole super radiance and sort of in ruling out some ultralight dark matter. So they're super cool. I recommend looking at them if that's your bag. Yeah.
You say if there exists a bosonic field, what are the properties of this? Like, we see accretion disks and things like that in black holes. Anything to do with, is it something that we know? What are the properties this boson needs to exist?
So I think that the thing is that you don't actually need any, it's not like an accretion disk, it's not like matter, right? It's that if you have any bosonic field that is on the order of the size of the black hole, which is what sets what masses you actually exclude, right? And it exists around a rotating black hole, any small lack of axisymmetry will cause this to begin to happen. So if you have like a perfectly, if you have sort of a perfectly homogeneous field of bosons, right, and you have a black hole spinning in the middle of it, any small lack of symmetry, basically, up to and including like a quantum fluctuation, will cause the bosons to start to sort of gather in these orbitals. And once you do, it's a runaway process. So you don't necessarily need anything to happen. You just need it to exist long enough that it's extremely unlikely that nothing would have caused this to happen. Does that make sense? Yeah? Other questions? Oh, sorry. Okay, great. So then this leaves just one decade, which thankfully is the thing I work on. All right, so now we're gonna talk about fuzzy dark matter. Okay. So the first thing I want to know that there are a bunch of related terms. So you might have heard about fuzzy dark matter or something approaching fuzzy dark matter under some of the following names. Wave dark matter, scalar dark matter, Beck dark matter, BEC dark matter, ultralight dark matter, that is what I call it in my papers, psi dark matter, ultralight axions, and more. So doing a full literature search is not simple. So here we are considering a range that is between 10 to the minus 30, approximately MA, and 10 to the minus 10-ish. EVs. So the first thing that we can say is if the mass of the axion is on the order to 10 to the minus 22 EV, which is sort of the canonical number for fuzzy. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, right. So I remember this number 10 to the minus 22 from Nick's lecture.
Yeah.
That was the E lower bound,
right?
That was the lower bound for the dark
matter. Not quite. So. I was told that he gave me homework to talk about some bounds. Okay, let me get through this bit, and then let's see if I answered your question, and if not, let's revisit it. Is that okay? So the reason we like 10 to the minus 22 or its neighborhood is that then the de Broglie wavelength of the particle is about 1 kiloparsec, which is about like dwarf galaxy sized. So what happens here is that a halo of dark matter will look something like this. So here I'm going to have log of the density on the vertical axis and log of the radial distance on the x-axis. And it'll look something like this. So it has two parts. It has what's called a core, or a soliton, that is vaguely on the order of 1 kiloparsec, or whatever the de Broglie wavelength is of the actual mass that we're considering. It'll have a skirt that goes down vaguely as r to the minus 3. The reason we like this, or rather, let me compare this first to a different kind of profile that you get from running sort of n-body simulations of dark matter, like even cosmological simulations over the dark matter. So on the outside here, you get something that looks very similar. And on the inside here, you get something that's called a cusp, where you have r to the minus 1. So this is if you use something called cold dark matter, which is just cosmologists speak for generic dark matter. It works on large scales, and on small scales, we're still thinking about it. Yeah.
Sorry, what's the word after 1 kiloparsec? The, like, right of...
Oh, dwarf, sorry.
Oh.
Like, about a dwarf galaxy size.
Oh.
That's a beautiful drawing of a galaxy, if you didn't know. Right. So from all these beautiful simulations of like large-scale structure that show us large-scale structure, basically how we see it in the universe, and we're super happy, we get the same behavior on large, at large distances. But on small scales, we get different behavior. And we actually like this because we have some observational evidence that the central part of galaxies look a little bit more like this. They have a core rather than a cusp. The counter argument to this is that the central part of a galaxy is usually where all of the baryons are. And here I'm using baryons in the cosmologist way of not dark matter. And so it could be that there are some astrophysical processes happening at the center of galaxies that sort of core out this cusp. The counter argument to that is that this is true in sort of dwarf galaxies where you don't have a lot of baryons and you have mostly dark matter at the center. So there's a back and forth there. Now, the important thing here is this core, not only because it is an observable difference between fuzzy dark matter and cold dark matter, but also because this is set by the mass of the particle. And so since we know that outside of this scale, we want it to behave like cold dark matter, just a second, we can rule out below like 10 to the minus 23 and say that here halos don't look like we expect them to. The core gets too large, the de Broglie wavelength gets too large. And so we can call this not dark matter because that's not what the halos look like that we see. Sorry, you had first thing.
I guess thinking, wouldn't we expect if we had a concentration of dark matter, wouldn't we expect a larger concentration of baryons? Because they fall into the...
Naively, yes. So that might have been true sort of in the first few giga years of the formation of the universe. But the thing is, galaxies get abused a whole lot before they get to a z equals of zero. So there are some merger events, there are some stripping events and stuff like that. So a lot of dynamics with maybe like bigger halos in the neighborhood could cause something like less baryons than we expect, because it's not always a clean process. Yeah?
I was wondering, for all these like hashed out regions, do you assume all of dark matter is?
Yes, yes. Very crucially, here we assume that all of dark matter is in whatever massive axion that I'm currently showing. When we relax that assumption, it gets a little bit different. Other questions right now? Okay. Right. So basically, so your question was, is there sort of a hard lower limit in 10 to the minus 22? The limit that I'm introducing right now, and then we'll talk about additional ones, is that sort of, well, you want it to be not any smaller than minus 22, 23, because then you get like very very ball-like halos, which is not what we see from observations. So that's where that limit comes from. On the other hand, fuzzy dark matter only goes down to like 10 to the minus 19-ish, because below that, this core gets so small that you don't see it, and you're basically just cold dark matter anyway. So that doesn't mean that you don't exist. It just means that you don't have the same phenomenology, because we're not looking for this core. It looks something like this, and then you can't detect it. Yeah?
Can you tell us where the skirt comes from in this wave model?
We're going to talk about where the skirt comes from in a minute. Also, I thought that skirt was a nomenclature that everybody used. It's been pointed out to me that I am the main person using it, but it's my lecture, so we're calling it a skirt. Other questions about this right now? OK, I think I'm finally out of boards, maybe? No. Ha, more boards. OK, so now that we have sort of talked about fuzzy dark matter as an axion that is like between 10 to the 19-ish and 10 to the minus 23 EV, let's talk about its dynamics and its phenom. So basically, what I can start with is the action of the action functional of a scalar field that's minimally coupled to gravity.
Okay. One question.
Yeah.
Where does the axion, or how does the axion acquire its mass? And why, like, if it's so small, I would think of, like, with the neutrino, why is it so small?
Ah, I see. Okay. So I think maybe Nick mentioned this, or I read it somewhere while watching the, sorry, who asked me the question? I wasn't looking. Hi. It acquires mass in different ways. So that sort of depends on how you motivate the axion. So for instance, you know, if you motivate it by sort of like, I don't know where the board went. If you motivate it by string theory, you can sort of find different mechanisms. So if it gains mass through sort of a QCD term, then it might be the QCD axion. If it gains mass through sort of some couplings to the electroweak sector, it might gain mass from there. I believe Nick talked about the misalignment mechanism. Does that sound familiar? And so because it's not thermally produced, it's not necessarily fast just because it's a low mass, because it's not the same thermal production mechanism that you might be used to with, say, WIMPs. So good question. Any other questions right now? Okay. So this part is what I just said, which is a scalar field phi minimally coupled to gravity. This part may exist. I'm going to drop it for now. But there is a version in which fuzzy dark matter has Quartic-style self-interactions. It's not explicitly forbidden. These are models that are built and tested all the time. And so often when we talk about, to go back to my note about nomenclature, ultra-light axions, that's like fuzzy dark matter with self-interactions. I'm going to drop it from the rest of my consideration and just talk about only coupling to gravity. But I just wanted to note that that is something that people are thinking about. So if I use the variational principle on this, I'll get equations that look something like this. And now I'm going to make some assumptions. So I'm going to assume that we're non-relativistic. We're going to assume that h bar is much, much less than m, which is the mass of the axion over h bar. So basically, we're in late times. So note that late here can still mean sort of the early epoch of structure formation. And with that in mind, I'm going to choose an ansatz for a field, or for phi rather, that looks like this.
Question for you.
Yeah.
The field is non-relativistic or the metric, or both of them?
Sorry, say again.
Metric is non-relativistic or field?
Or both. Both. So we're totally going to take it to the maximum sort of non-relativistic limit. So with this ansatz, I can then, actually, I'm just going to erase this. I can substitute this ansatz and get equations that may or may not be surprising to you, depending on how much you've thought about this. So if you substitute that, and by the way, if you're looking for, back down, if you're looking for the full derivation, I like the one in this reference. I think it follows it quite nicely. But anyway, so with that ansatz, you get a couple of equations. You get I h bar psi dot is equal to negative h bar squared 2m. That bad, huh? Okay. Right. So what you get here is a good friend, the Schrodinger equation. And what you get here is a good friend, the Poisson equation. So here, psi is the wave function of the axiom, like of the dm particle, right? Phi is the gravitational potential. And since if I'm an observer, I don't care about wave functions, I care about more tangible things. What we have also is rho, the density of dark matter. Which is the absolute value of psi squared times m, which is the mass of the axion. OK. Questions about that? Yeah?
Sorry, I just can't see. What's your condition for late times?
H much less than m over h bar. I realized that I dropped h bar, and then I introduced it again. So my bad. That's part of my notes. But we use natural units in this house. Just ignore all h bars and c's. They're all one anyway. OK, can I get the screen down, please? Thanks, God.
God likes you.
Do we need to hit the screen on? Ah, no. I love it when things work. Okay, so this is, just to get back, this is the sort of the exclusion plot that I drew for the QCD axion. So I got it from this paper. It's the same one that I wrote out. But these are sort of the two models that most people look for. And then these are the kind of exclusion plots that you're making. Note the very important y-axis that doesn't matter at all in my work. This is just an intro to ultralight dark matter. But basically, what I wanted to show you is one of these halos being formed. So what I do is I study this thing computationally, right? So I run a lot of very expensive simulations. And so to back up, we said that a fuzzy dark matter halo looks a little bit something like this. Now, what I didn't tell you is this core or soliton is just its ground state. So this will loop and loop, but the two little circles that you see, so those are two solitons. Those are just two ground states of the wave function that are merging together to form a halo. So this is one of the ways to form a fuzzy dark matter halo in the literature. There are other ways. This is just the simplest in what I use. And so this is a slice through the center of my box. But after these two things merge, there are two things to notice. So you notice the little yellow circle in the center that's oscillating. That is this core, which is one of the observables of fuzzy dark matter. And then the other thing to notice is that all around it's, well, for lack of a better word, fuzzy. So all of these sort of, all of this interference fringes will also be an interesting phenomenological concept, which is also how we place constraints in this model. So those are the two things that I want to highlight here. The next thing to highlight is that if you take a simulation like this, and sort of spherically average the profile and plot it, it looks a little bit something like this. Excuse me, I don't know what's happening. It looks a little bit something like this, right? Where I've put it into units that are palatable to an astronomer, but again, units don't super matter. So what I'm showing you here is the spherically average profile of the halo. The black is just the time average of all of these. And you can see that the overall profile doesn't change that much. It sort of bobs up, it bobs down, but it's a very consistent, profile. And if it's consistent in density, that means that the sort of spherically averaged gravitational potential profile is pretty constant. So that means that we can calculate its eigenstates. The way that we do that is to basically take this phi. I was going to write this out on the board, but it might be simpler this way. So what we're going to do is we're going to take this phi, which at this point depends on time. We have a whole equation to move it forward. And we're just going to say, what if this is some static, right? It doesn't depend on time, it just depends on distance. Then you can sort of get rid of the Poisson equation and the rho equation. And then you're left with a time-independent Schrodinger equation. So once again, we've sort of taken an ultralight axion system and diminished it down to more or less the hydrogen atom. You can make an ansatz, like with the hydrogen atom, that the radial component and phi and theta are separable. And you can make Mathematica calculate your eigenstates, which look a little something like this. So these things are normally indexed same as the hydrogen atom. I'm going to abuse this board because it's the cleanest. So they are indexed by N, L, and M. Here, what I'm showing you all have M equals to 0. And that is just the radial component. I'm not showing you the spherical harmonic bit. So basically, these are all axisymmetric, not for any special reason other than it's hard to show three dimensions in two dimensions. Yeah.
Yeah, I have a basic question.
Yeah.
Clarify. So cold dark matter is, this dark matter is also cold in a sense, non-relativistic, right? It just itself interacts, so it forms solitons, right?
So
distinction between the two.
Not quite. So cold dark matter is sort of a generic name that cosmologists use. It could be WIMPs, it could be axions, but it can't be these axions because these axions show a core that is different. So they behave differently on smaller scales.
So it's cold, actually. It's non-cold because cold reserved for those that form the halos that are actually.
So this is where nomenclature goes great. It is cold, but it's not CDM.
Okay.
Cold dark matter is used for a very specific thing. This is dark matter that is cold, if you like. Yeah.
Going back to phi.
Yeah.
You found psi, but you have for phi, you have some of the wave packets moving around, right?
Yeah.
So something should be radiating away, or what's going on with phi, basically?
What's going on with phi is I introduce it as a motivation for how I get to psi. So you, instead of looking at phi, you can think about psi instead. So psi is the wave function here, and that is the that is what my halo is made out of. That is the thing that moves. That is the thing that I'm trying to observe.
Sure, but again, gives rise to the question: when we sub psi back into phi, we can get some. In terms of observables, basically, does phi represent anything?
No. What you're observable is density. So what you're observable is m times psi squared. But what you use to propagate the system forward when you're when you're computationally modeling it is psi. Does that make sense?
I suppose related to that.
Yeah.
Final clarification. So in like old standard quantum mechanics, right?
Yeah.
You interpret psi squared as a probability then.
Yeah.
But here you actually use it for like an actual mass.
So you multiply it by the mass of the particle, which is how you get away with that units wise. So I guess the thing is that this is all sort of, I like to think of this as inspired by quantum because you're using a lot of the sort of methods and terminology that you first learned in quantum mechanics. But I cannot stress enough that this is a classical system because it's huge, right? It's a halo. It's on the size of a kiloparsec. So it's not proper quantum mechanics. You don't have like angular momentum quantization or anything like that. So it's pseudo quantum mechanics. It's a pseudo quantum mechanical scalar, if you like. Other questions? Yeah.
Yeah, like this concept also, I mean, it combines somehow quantum mechanics with gravity. And I mean, okay, in general, you just have the Schrodinger equation, you have some potential. But how settled is this that you can actually use gravitational potentials in a quantum mechanical system?
So again, it's not a quantum mechanical system. It's a classical limit of a system. So it's a classical wave function that we're considering here.
Okay.
So that's the big difference. Trust me, if I'd figured out quantum gravity, I would have been yelling it from the rooftops.
Wave functions of particles.
Yeah, it's a wave function of particles that basically says that if I'm considering some halo that has like 10 to the 9 solar masses or something like that, if I'm building it out of something like WIMPs computationally, I can track particles that aren't individual WIMP particles, but are sort of masses of WIMPs that I'm tracking moving around my numerical box. If I have axions that are 10 to the minus 22 EV, I can't even in principle do that because there's too many of them. So it's just a different sort of description. This is why it's called wave dark matter.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Kind of.
Okay, I saw you and then you.
Can you get the same equation via like the Madelung wave function?
Yes, you can use the Madelung representation. Yes.
So it is Gross-Pitayevsky equation.
Yes, it's the Gross-Pitayevsky equations, yeah.
I mean, it's just
like it quacks like a duck. It is not a duck. So it's not quantum because you're looking at like a bulk motion of a Bose-Einstein condensate that is extremely large. You're not looking at like, you know, the analogy is very helpful and I use it, but it is not quantum all the way, because again, you don't have things like quantization of angular momentum, which you would need.
So the equation of motion came from the action you wrote down,
yeah,
and which ended up being the Schrodinger equation. As an analogy for some quantum, I know this is not quantum, but as an analogy,
yeah.
Sometimes we can use also the Kling-Orton equation, for example, to model the higher atom.
Yeah.
If you use the Kling-Orton equation, do you get something else? Or?
No, you can get there from the Klein-Gordon equation, I think. I just didn't want to start that far back because I sort of wanted to start, I wanted to get to the point where I show you the pretty pictures.
The question is, it does make sense to use the Kling-Orton equation in this system.
Well, so it depends. So I think if you wanted to model sort of what is happening with this super early in the universe, you might want to start from the Kling-Orton equation, right? For my purposes, where I'm thinking about a single halo in the late universe, then that is more information that I need. Does that make sense? Ish?
Thanks.
Other questions? Okay. No? Okay. Right. So what I want to focus on here is the ground state, which I've sort of already given away, is this soliton core that we have here. Once again, I'm going to struggle to lower this board. Oh, no. Is there another board? I can't get it. Never mind. Thank you. So what I want to emphasize here, this is red. Whatever. I'm just going to write in red. Oh, no. There. Can you tell I haven't written on a blackboard in a long time? So what we have is a halo that is that we can basically decompose of these into these eigenstates. And I'm just going to show you the spherically symmetric states just for ease of illustration, but they are all there. So a halo that looks something like this, right, is actually consists of the ground state here, n equals 1, plus some n equals 1 state. Yep, 0, you're right, plus some higher state, et cetera. Right, so this ground state here, this is the soliton, and this is the thing that is making up my core that I care about. And so this is, I don't know, depends on the halo, but let's say this is about 50% of the density of the halo, or I guess, yeah, whatever, 50%. And then this can be something like 20%, this can be something like 10%, et cetera, et cetera. They go lower and lower. And so these excited states sort of add a little bit to the center, but not a lot. And they add sort of one bump here. The next one adds two bumps here. The next one adds three bumps here. And so together, they make up this r to the minus 3 behavior, rho, in rho, which is the thing that I like. That is the thing that is helping me reproduce the large scale structure of the universe in a way that doesn't break all of the wonderful progress that we've made. So said another way, then there are sort of two types of observables that I want to care about when I'm looking for fuzzy dark matter. So on the one hand, I want to look for the core or the soliton ground state. So this will show results such as being different from the cusp in CDM. So if I can measure the profiles of galaxies and I'm seeing cores, I can, you know, then I can say, what mass of axion do I need to have a core that size, and can I explain all of the cores? Another way to think about it is that I basically have a cutoff in the small scale of a power spectrum, which I'll show in a minute. Because I basically, if the size of this core is set by the de Broglie wavelength, which is set by a mass, I can't have a halo that's smaller like this, because halos don't look like a soliton. So in that sense, it's sort of similar to warm dark matter or self-interacting dark matter, if you're familiar with those two models. The second thing that I'm looking for is what I call the skirt, or really the wiggles in the skirt. So these wiggles and that interference pattern that you saw up there, which can induce dynamical heating in systems. Especially interesting for cold systems, such as stellar streams and dwarfs. And by studying what kind of modes are present, I can directly predict some qualitative behavior of these systems. So what I mean by that is that if I take a ground state and superimpose one of the excited states, there are different behaviors that I get. So if you think about this as just the core of the halo, superimposing the 1-0 state, this is, yeah, so this is L equals 0, N equals 1 state. What you get, it's what's called a breathing mode. So you get oscillations in the core, which are something that you can look for. Somebody's laughing because somebody's on this paper. If I add a L equals 1 mode, I get this sort of random motion of the center of mass, which makes it extremely annoying to simulate because sometimes it wants to run away from the center of your box. And if I add an L equals 2 mode, what I get is something that looks like a quadruple. So if you sort of really stared at the halo that I showed you evolving before, you would see all of these modes. So this, and I believe the next one, are from a really good review paper that I super like on ultralight dark matter in general. So if this interests you more, I highly recommend it. So this is what I was talking about in terms of the cutoff in the power spectrum of fuzzy dark matter, similar to, say, warm dark matter, and very different from cold dark matter. So these are the bits that are unconstrained. This is the small, small scale, large K. And so this is where we have, this is where we're looking for the different observables to distinguish it from just cold dark matter. Yeah.
Regarding the previous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does that break spherical symmetry?
What do you mean by does it break spherical symmetry?
Yeah, maybe I'm not getting the here. Like there's a symmetry breaking in these different terms. We're supposed to add them?
So these are three cases of where I just put down a ground state and put down some bit about an excited state and watch how the whole system moved.
Okay.
Right, so this is like 70% ground state, 30% whatever state that I'm giving.
That means that we could have these halos not symmetric halos.
They're not symmetric.
Oh, okay.
They're not asymmetric. I'm making an approximation that they are approximately symmetric in order to calculate the eigenstates in order to get sort of some information about them.
And can we measure that breaking of symmetry in galaxies?
It's hard because generally what you get are rotation curves, and so generally what you get are sort of like already spherically, like the universe already kind of spherically averages them for us, right, based on our observations. So, you know, if you had sort of like a toy universe in a box and you could look at it and you could poke it, yes, but in practice, I think it's very hard to make those measurements. Yeah.
Very nice. Asking, what would make the excited the state excited?
I'm calling it excited because it's not the ground state.
So, I mean, what physical thing drives the system to be in the grounded state or under a state?
So I guess it sort of depends on how you're setting up your system. Here, the physics that is driving it is that I made it be that way. So I guess the question you're really asking is how do these halos form? Right. So what I said that I do is I take two already ground states because they're easy to initialize in my code. This is purely a numerical convenience thing, and I smash them together. That energy of the smash together excites some excited states which form the skirt, and then I have a full halo. In practice, what you probably have happen is something called spherical or elliptical collapse. But how these things would form early in the universe and what that looks like is still very much under study.
So basically, the initial condition sets the final state, right? There are no additional things.
Sorry, what do you mean?
The initial condition of how the system forms, if, for example, a dwarf galaxy or something like that, as you mentioned earlier, the initial condition when it's forming sets the state of the halo.
Not necessarily, because you could imagine So you can imagine a halo forming with some initial condition and then merging with another halo. And that act of a merger will excite different modes and will change the actual makeup. So this is sort of, this is the difficult thing, which is that most of the halos that we have the best access to are close by, which means they've gone through billions and billions of years of dynamical friction and merging with other halos and AGN feedback and stuff like that. Which is why JWST is nice, for instance, because then you see really baby halos that haven't really gone through all of that. You don't see them quite as well as you see the nearby ones, but you see them much better than we've ever seen them before. So that's one of the reasons that people are super excited for these early JWST halos that we're able to see. This is where I reveal myself to be an astronomer. Yeah.
Yeah. How successful are this dark matter to describe the relic density? Because you said earlier that the cold dark matter is very successful in describing that.
What do you mean by the relic density?
Yeah, like the formation. So you get the current dark matter abundance.
Oh.
Cosmological.
Oh, I see. I mean, you can tune it to get you can tune it to get the sort of such that omega of dark matter is all in fuzzy dark matter. Of course, the issue you run into then is some of the exclusions that I'm about to show. Because we don't observe some of those things, right? So you can always tune it to be thus. It's just a question of does it stand up under scrutiny? And so more and more the answer for this is no if you expect it to be all of dark matter.
Okay.
Sorry, I think I had a question up here.
Oh.
No?
I just want to comment, like, you know, maybe now with what we, like, what we may find out about the stochastic background, maybe we can figure out if it'll settle into an ergodic state that will match.
You mean the stochastic background from Nanograph?
Yeah.
I have that figure at the end.
Oh, okay.
Somebody already did exclusions, don't you worry. You had a question?
Yeah, I also remember that you have to have a specific velocity for the top, and you can also get it right, right? This 10 to the
minus
3.
Yeah. You can basically tune it to be right. That's just a model building problem. The question is then, you can build a very fine universe out of fuzzy dark matter. Mm-hmm. It may not be the universe we live in.
Okay.
It's sort of
mass with it, right? Because in the equations, you only get the only parameter is mass, basically, right?
Yeah. So the way to the velocity to calculate sort of the velocity of this thing, you would have to go into the Madelung representation, and then you look at the phase. The phase contains the velocity information. Yes.
Well, I think I'm sure I understand the way that you've broken the halo down.
Yeah.
Eigenstates, because the eigenstates aren't really stationary states, right? Because they gravitate. It's a nonlinear equation of motion.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Are these like just some steady state distribution that you observe in the?
Yeah. So this is sort of a useful way of thinking of these things in the interaction picture. If you calculate sort of eigenstates that are stationary and then let your halo move, so these are predetermined eigenstates that are based on some best guess at an average gravitational potential. So they're not the true eigenstates of the full system at any given moment, but they're sort of a useful pedagogical tool to watch this thing move from one eigenstate to another, especially if you're sort of trying to say something about, say, the size of the core, because then you can look directly at the ground state rather than doing some like fitting and catching some of the higher excited states that are contributing at the center. Yeah?
Yep, thank you.
Other questions? Okay. You know what, I forgot where I am, so let's just chat. So the power spectrum, this cutoff is sort of due to the fact that you have a minimum size of halo that you can get, because you can't get a halo lower than the size of the core. So that is one way that people put limits on it. So a lot of this is from the same paper that I just showed you, which is a review paper. You can see our two black hole super radiance sort of exclusions, and then everything you see on the left here from 10 to the minus 22. So this might be what Nick was talking about when he said that 10 to the minus 22 is sort of the lower limit, which is that you start to run into these large scale exclusions, right? Because you wash out too much of the structure on too big a scale. You're basically, your core gets too bloated. There's different arguments here. I'm sort of squashing a lot of good work into one sentence, but that's one way to think about it. Because I figured somebody would ask, the Nanograph people already, well, it's not actually Nanograph, I think this is from the European timing array, but in any way, there is already a paper putting limits on ultralight dark matter and wavelight dark matter from the pulsar signal. And so I sort of skimmed this right before coming here because I figured people would be interested in it. But the general idea is that because of these wiggles and because of this sort of breathing mode that I mentioned, because these systems are very dynamic and have some oscillations on some time period, you expect to see those oscillations between pulsars, and between the pulsars and the Earth. So these things should be correlated if we're within a de Broglie wavelength of whatever axion field that exists, because then we're within one system, or uncorrelated if you're sort of between different halos that might be oscillating, or that might be in different phase of their oscillation. And so using something like this, they put some limits on how much of dark matter can be made up of axions in this mass range. So as you see, this is minus 24 to minus 22.6. So we already saw some more stringent mass bounds than that. But they say that basically around here, it can be less than the total dark matter density. So that is the latest and greatest from there. Okay. Any questions at this point? Yeah.
So is it saying that when the horizontal line, which is dark matter density, intersects with the correlated plot, that's the mass range where it would be the entire axiom.
Yeah, yeah. So I think above there it is allowed to be. This is not by far the most stringent constraint on this, but it is an interesting constraint because it's from like a different mechanism than the other ones. So yeah, if you're less than 10 to the minus 23, you cannot be all of dark matter is what I believe that they are saying. Yeah.
Yeah, like if you include the self-interaction, how it changes the behavior of that function.
Right, okay. So then I'll just say my sort of, because I end on sort of a grim note for ultralight dark matter, I wanna say a few positive things about it. So the number one thing that and this will tie into what you're asking. So the number one thing I wanted to say about it is that it's cool that you can treat these things almost quantumly when they're really enormous. I understand that it's also sort of confusing, but I think it's a real testament to the creativity in the field that there are all of these different ways to put bounds in what is essentially the same type of particle, just based on different masses. I wanted to say that, so everything that I presented doesn't assume the quartic self-interaction. You do have an expert here who works on this this dark matter with the quartic self-interactions. You get more interesting phenomenology, and most of the most of these constraints were made without self-interactions in mind. So the parameter space is much bigger with self-interactions. I haven't done the eigenstate analysis on these self-interactions because then my little trick of treating the Schrodinger-Poisson system as a tiny independent Schrodinger equation doesn't work in quite the same way. But if somebody has a brilliant idea, I'd love to read that paper. And the last thing that I wanted to say is, I erased that board, by string theory, if you take that seriously, if we have one axion-like field, we might as well have many. Which is to say that another tale of caution is that all of these constraints are for ultralight dark matter being all of the dark matter budget of the universe, which is not necessarily true. If we naturally predict multiple axion fields and multiple masses, that clears up a whole load of parameter space, and there's much work to be done there. I thought I would talk for so much longer. All right, are there any other questions, or do you want to be let go after 2 weeks of physics?
No,
I forgot how long it takes to write on a blackboard, so I thought that I had too many notes, but apparently not.
All right, any other questions?
You can ask Cliff things.
Sounds like you got a lot of questions at the top. So thank you for wrapping things up so nicely.